Well, it's been a while, but we're going to get back into the book of Exodus tonight. But before we do, I want to open us this evening by beginning in 1 Corinthians 10. I think we've read it before, but it has special application tonight. So turn to 1 Corinthians 10. I like to do this whenever we get an opportunity because it's important for us to understand this is one book you have, not two, not some ancient history, and then, you know, the New Testament, and then we get to throw out the Old Testament. This is one book, and they are tied together, and we need to take every opportunity to see that. So 1 Corinthians 10, and if you get there, just hold your finger, and let's pray one more time. Father, may you bless us now in the reading of your word. Thanks for letting us have this place where we can come together, a place we take so quickly for granted. You're so good to us. It's nice to be here with you tonight, Lord. Let your spirit be here upon us and help us to be more like you. Help us to learn from the pages of history and that we might not be doomed to repeat all those same things. Amen. 1 Corinthians 10. Let's read a little of this. It says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all of our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. But with most of them God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our example, into the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they lusted." I'm going to stop right there. One of the things I wanted to emphasize was they all drank from the same spiritual drink. They drank from the same spiritual rock that followed them. So now take your Bibles and let's turn to our text today to Exodus 17. Beginning in verse 1, he says, "Then and all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin," and that has no relationship to the English word sin, by the way. It's just their name. "Wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord. And they encamped in Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, 'Give us water that we may drink.' And Moses said to them, 'Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?' And the people thirsted there for water. And the people complained against Moses and said, 'Why is it you brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?'" Okay, we'll stop there for just a minute now. Many of you that have been here as we've been going through the book of Exodus and this whole story with Moses, you would probably recognize this. It's like, gee, have we had this kind of speech before? Well, in effect, yes. Because once again, the people have forgotten the power and the grace of God. Already, they have quickly forgotten, they have disregarded, if you will, all that he'd done, all the miraculous that had taken place, all that they had witnessed, parting of the Red Sea, the provision of the manna, the provision of the quail, and the list goes on and on. And now, the difficulty comes again, and the first thing they do is squeal. Corinthians there, the passage we just read tells us that this event that we read here was a picture of Christ shedding his blood for us upon the cross. We often see that in the Old Testament. They are what we call shadows, Old Testament shadows of what would come in the New Testament. Today we're very fond of, the world seems to be very fond of saying that God is hard to know and the Bible's hard to know, and it's all such a mystery, and we like to use those great words. And you know, I don't know what else God could have done to make it more plain to us. All through the whole Testament, he goes, "Hey, check this out. You see this? This is what I'm going to do, okay?" And then later on, "Okay, check this out. You see this here? Okay, this is what I'm going to do, okay? Just remember this, because I'm going to do this, okay?" And then you get there, and he goes, "Oh, there, I did it, there. See, just like I said." You know? And then people today are going, what was that? I missed that. God has made every attempt to communicate with us, gang. He's not messing with you. He's not holding his will or his plan behind his back. I mean, he even speaks of this fact. He says, you know, you're so smart. You look at the sky in the morning. You know it's going to rain. You see all this stuff going on, but you're just missing everything that I'm trying to do here. I think oftentimes we see what we want to see, huh? But these are Old Testament types, Old Testament shadows, Old Testament prophetic fulfillment, new fulfillment pictures, is that all weaves together. Way back in the garden, when Adam and Eve started this entire mess for all of us, it wasn't like God was just kind of playing it by ear. Well, we'll see how it all works out, and, you know, and just, well, I better do this, I better do that. Clear back in the garden, he knew all this was going to happen. He knew what he was going to do. He knew how it was going to play out. I don't know about you guys, but I take great comfort in that. So there, a lot of us, sadly, live our lives just like these guys. I mean, God does this great work of care for us. He comes to our rescue. And so in response, we fall to our knees and worship. The problem is, once the crisis is averted, and then we so quickly forget and we go rolling on back to our vomit, as 2 Peter 2:22 says. And then we begin the whole process over again. Some of us have spent 10, 20, 30, 40 years going around and around like that. I'm always very amazed at people's, how quickly they're willing to throw large blocks of their life away. You know, I'm not here to pick on the ex-governor of California, but, you know, I'm listening to that and it's like, dude, 25 years of marriage, it's just gone. You know, I guess I'll just start on over again. And how many people that I've known, that you've known, that maybe even were amongst us, that walked with Christ and lived for Christ, taught for Christ, and they had it going on for years, maybe a decade even, and then I'm just going to, you know, throw it away and go on back to the world. It's like, you do know you don't get a lot of decades, right? I mean, there's just a few. I think it would behoove us all to learn. Try not to repeat the same mistakes over again. Try to hear the voice of God. You're not going to outlast him, you know. He has ultimate patience. He'll just wait you out. He'd been waiting for thousands of years. You're not going to outwait him. Every difficult thing that we have in our life, gang, is an event in which we're going to go one way or another. Every trial, every testing, we're either going to go forward or we're going to go backwards. We're going to move on or we're going to quit. And the fact is, there are so many folks, and I guess maybe I had to get to this age to really see this, but I mean, the amount of folks that are willing to pack it in and head it on back to Egypt when things get difficult, it's astonishing. It's like, did you forget Egypt? Bondage, make bricks, you know, with no straw. Remember that whole thing? I mean, that was bad, right? What are you going back there for? We forget. We start to think maybe things are better back where we started. And it happens so oftentimes when we get bored, we get impatient, like these people roaming here through the wilderness. They get bitter. We get lustful for worldly things. Fact is, tonight, if you have a breaking point, then sooner or later, one day, you're going to break. If you have a price to walk away from God, I promise you Satan will offer it to you. And the amazing thing is too, and I guess, you know, I'm full of pearls of old age wisdom tonight. You know, you watching this, you see people go, yes, I don't want this Christian thing because this thing over here. And what happened is that the devil has offered you that. And so, yeah, I want that so bad, I'll walk away. And then he gives it to you, and then he jerks it out of your hands. And he just laughs at you. You don't get to negotiate with Satan. He hates you. He's going to mess with you and do everything he can to take you out. But if you have a price, you'll pay it. If you have a breaking point, you will stand at that threshold and look across. They put their hand to the plow and looked back. And we know that the Gospels tell us that those who do are not fit for the kingdom of God. I want you to notice, before we go on to here, notice that Moses was the object of the people's anger and scorn. But Moses was smart enough to know that it wasn't really at him. It was at God. People have an aversion of kind of getting all up in God's face. I mean, no one wants to kind of stand out in the yard and shake their face at the sky and call God names, so they shake their face, their fist at the pastor and call him names. And the problem is, I've heard it so much now that I don't lose any sleep. I sleep really well. But see, they're all up in Moses' face here because things aren't going the way they wanted it to go. So they direct their hatred towards a man here. And we still tend to do that, you know? We it's the government's fault. That's the one we have now, you know. We're in terrible economic decline. It's the government's fault. And it's like, really? Have you done the math? Because now maybe you individually aren't the problem, but have you, you know what they say about what every man, woman, and child owes, like personal debt? It's astronomical. If we got an economic problem in this country, we did this. It's because good old MasterCard did this. We spent more than we had, and we want things. We want Vikings football stadiums. I'm glad I'm not on that side of the river. And, you know, we want all this stuff. We want perfect roads and all the rest, but we don't want to pay for it. We want universal health care. We don't pay for it. And, Tim, you're getting political. See, the deal is I'm not the one in charge, and Moses understood that too. He said, dudes, I'm not the one in charge, God is. And that's what I'm the same way. I'm not in charge, God is. See, if someone is unhappy, they need to take it up with the Lord. And you guys need to remember this. This goes for me, this went for Moses, this goes for everyone who is in spiritual leadership, or everyone you'd like to get up in their face. God has the power to take me out. You do know that, right? See, it's real easy. All joking aside, and I don't have time to get into this tonight, but those of you who attend here, you know the stuff that's happened in the Philippines. Very, very strong suspicions that God just took a couple people out dead because they messed with the work there. That's a whole other story I'll tell you about sometime if you're like, really? What I'm saying is God can kill you. He can do whatever he wants. So you need to take a step back and realize who's in charge. God's in charge. So Moses at least is smart enough to know this. And I tell you, any man or woman who's in any kind of leadership position, this is something you want to learn very, very quickly, or otherwise you're just going to lose your mind. I'm just the messenger. So now, I want to point out something here too. They were asking for water. Asking for water is not sin. Okay, that wasn't the problem here. Let me go in a step further. Asking for a wife, gentlemen, it's not a sin. Asking for a car so you can get to work, that's not a sin. Asking for money to pay your rent, that's not a sin either. But demanding it and throwing a temper tantrum when you don't get it, that's something else. Because that's saying, I want to one-up your vote, God. Okay? Moses acknowledged that both the provision here as well as the battle was not his, but it was God's. Let's go on. Verse 4, one verse. So Moses cried to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. Now Moses, he goes to God with this, and rightfully so. Moses seems to know when something's too big for him to handle, when things are getting out of control, and he goes to the feet of the Lord. He does, however, I don't want to read between the lines, but he does seem to be expressing a note of exasperation here, though, doesn't he? What am I going to do with these people? The people's lack of maturity here is overwhelmingly evident. Let's take a look at what is really the scene before us. The people were short on water, and they moved immediately to, we're all going to die. You be with people like that, that's always like the worst case scenario. That's it. We're dead. We're finished. And I think that's where they are. But that also shows the level of maturity. It's not that they didn't have enough faith in God. They didn't have any faith in God. Now, another evidence of their maturity level is that they quickly turn to anger and violence. I mean, it is really astonishing to see people who, and maybe you know these people, who were once meek and mild, who become fire-breathing dragons when the flesh gained the upper hand. You know, it's like they used to be really nice people, and then it's like, and it, just because they've got all bitter and angry. And all that does is expose our wicked hearts. It exposes our self-centeredness, exposes our lack of maturity. People haven't changed. That's the wonderful thing about the Old Testament. When you read this, it isn't like, well, people would never do that now. Oh, yes, we would. Yeah, we're doing it all the time. Maybe I can compare notes with Moses when I get there. Verse 5. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I'll stand before you there on the rock of Horeb. And you shall strike the rock and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel and because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord amongst us or not? So instead of naming the place lots of water or oh, hey, this is great, we got water, whatever that translates into. No, it gets named contention of the people, tempted the Lord, not good memories. Now, I want you to notice that Moses didn't resolve the problem. He merely obeyed God resolved the problem. Now, the people were asking, is God amongst us or not? Now, those of us that are sitting here, we've had kind of the Cliff Notes version of this story. It all happened in fairly speedy time. But, I mean, are you with me when you stand here and go, is the Lord with you or not? I don't know. When an ocean opens up and I walk across on dry land, something's happening there. You know, the whole manna business, the quail falling out of the sky. I mean, isn't it amazing? How does that affect us? Well, I think we need to stop and think about that once in a while. We can go through a difficult time, and I'm speaking firsthand here. We can go through a difficult time. We can go through a troubled issue. And I start to like, what's going on? You know, where are you, God? Just because things aren't going as good as I'd like them to be. And we need to stop and go, wait a minute. Have we seen the hand of God manifest in this church? A thousandfold. God has done enough for this church that if he never did another thing for the rest of our lives, we should stand in awe. But we forget, don't we? We need to be remembered or to be reminded. So these guys were a lot like people today. Moses now, he knows that what needs to happen in this situation is we need to go to God, we need to be praying, we need to have faith. That's what happens when we go through hardship. That's what happens when we go through difficulty. We're supposed to go to the Lord. We're supposed to be put at his feet and say, Lord, I don't know what's going on here. I don't know what you're going to do here. This is what I'd like. There's nothing wrong with that. Thy will be done. Because you're the man. You're in charge. And then rest in that. I wonder how many of us see God like a rich uncle or something. You know, he's just supposed to come by and shower us with gifts and property and comfort. So when things, we don't get that. Whoa, is God here or not? Because we only equate God with good stuff. You know, I'm supposed to be all giddy like I'm at Disneyland all the time. And everything's supposed to be wonderful. I'm supposed to get everything I want. I'm supposed to get everything that I desire to do, I get to do. And life's supposed to be very comfortable. And I'm just kind of living in this little fantasy land. Where does God say that in the Bible? Because I read about this, and the fact is, it's lots of times it's tough being a Christian. How oftentimes we whine, where's God, when we get into those times of difficulty and when we get in those times of testing? Because, as I say, we automatically separate God from hardship. Just proving that we see him as kind of a cosmic Santa Claus too. The people here in the desert, they thought that they were merely traveling to a destination. That everything in between didn't really matter. I'm here and I'm going there. And they had to learn, just as we have to learn so oftentimes, that God is using the journey, gang, to grow us, to test us, to mature us. I mean, that's called life. If you are learning and growing and maturing, people are still using this same principle today. It's always, well, it's happening. That's the goal out there, and nothing in between. The children of Israel would be tested again and again. And let's acknowledge something. A lot of their testing was because they didn't learn the lesson the first time. And nothing is more pitiful than that. It's like, dude, how many times are you going to do this? I mean, it didn't work the first time or the second or the tenth. You think you might try another method. Because this isn't working. And so we think, well, I'll just keep going. Once again, we're talking God here. You're not going to outweigh God. And so we see a lot of biblical characters going around, 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 around because they just didn't learn. Now, we know the end of the story. What happens to this bunch? They die out there in the wilderness, walking around and around in circles. How'd you like to get to your death and it's like, so how was life? Well, I pretty much just walked around in circles out here in the desert. That's it? Yeah, that's all I did, just walked around the desert. But God gave me manna. Well, bravo for you. There's a couple of them that said, not me. I'm going over. I'm going to have the promised land. But it was God's plan or not at all. We are the most stubborn of people. There's a pastor that speaks of the cul-de-sac of stupidity. Never forgot about that. Because these guys, they died in that cul-de-sac of stupidity 40 years going around and around in circles. Let's go on. Verse 8. Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands became too heavy, so they took a stone and they put it under him and he sat on it. And Aaron and Ur supported his hands, one on one side, the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called its name, the Lord is my banner. For he said, because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Now, this is kind of a famous story. You very familiar. You may know this story already. For anyone in ministry, this story has a very poignant meaning. Anyone who's in ministry oftentimes clings to this story a great deal. First of all, a little background. The Amalekites were the nation that descended from Esau. So trace your own back. That didn't go too good right from the get-go. And now already the Amalekites are a problem. They would long be a thorn in the side of Israel. Now, this is the first mention, this passage here, the first mention of Joshua. We're going to hear a lot about Joshua in the weeks to come. He would have had to have been a relatively young man at this point. He would become, if he wasn't already, one of Moses' right-hand men. So as the story goes here, as long as Moses obediently held his arms up in intercession and in dependence upon God, the victory would be in the hands of Israel. And when he brought the hands down, the battle would then slide in favor of the Amalekites. So this all went well and good until Moses started to get tired. He grew weary. His arms grew heavy. Now, thankfully, even despite the fact that a lot of the people were kind of all up in Moses' face, there were some men that stood loyal beside Moses. And Moses was able to look to these guys for support. Aaron, his brother, and this guy named Ur. We don't know too much about this guy. Each one of them would stand on one side, one on the other, and they would hold Moses' hands up. Now, to this day, Bible-centered churches and fellowships literally around the world, for them, this adage remains absolutely strong. Because there are still, in this church too, those who hold the pastor's arms up to assure victory. And, you know, they're really the unsung heroes. I think that these men are, you know, greatly unappreciated, seldom acknowledged. But let me tell you something clearly tonight, if I haven't made it clear before. Without them, I would fail. Without them, I would not make it. And thus, neither would this community. I think it's often, this isn't in any way a chastisement, just a reality, that I think it's easy oftentimes to come to church, sit in the pew, and you really don't have any concept or any understanding of what goes on here, you know, the rest of the week, all day long, every day. It's busy. If you're just, you know, a guest here, you don't know. I mean, we have 3 full-time pastors here and a full-time secretary. There's 4 of us. And, you know, no one's, you know, hanging out, you know, with a Rubik's Cube killing time here. You know, it's really, really busy. And right now, by the way, I might add, we're less than 2 weeks away from Team 1 leaving for the Philippines. So if we're all just a little bit crazy, it's because we're all a little bit crazy. And we're in really, really high gear around here. So if I, you know, seem kind of aloof, it's because I am. I'm in the Philippine zone, you know. And so we're very, very busy. The Team One's got a youth camp we're preparing to do over there. And there's just a whole lot of stuff. Those who have gone with me, you know that we hit the ground running and you pour us back on that plane again and, you know, we collapse and fly us home. So it's busy. It's crazy. We got a lot going on. I'm not complaining. I love it. I mean, that's the world I've created, so I have no one to blame but myself. But what I'm saying is it takes all the leadership here. If I am a success at all in the ministry, it's because I have surrounded myself with successful men. That's it. Maybe you don't even know who the other pastors are in this church and who are the elders in this church and who the ministerial staff are in this church. And all these people, they hold my arms up. They keep me going. This may be just an absolute surprise to you guys, but I'm not always the easiest guy to get along with. I know. Shocked, aren't you?
And so they put up with me, you know. They know when I'm carrying on and just, you know, that I didn't really mean to break into Watergate. I was just talking, okay? If you don't know about that, then you're young. So I cannot thank these guys enough, because they're the ones. They're the ones who are holding me up, and they're the ones who are making sure that we're victorious. Bottom line for any ministerial leader is that there's going to be those who want to stone you, and there's going to be those who are going to hold your arms up and make you succeed. And there's always going to be both sides of that. Then there's this vast mass of people in between. They're, I guess, what I would call the situational folks. I mean, if things go their way, if there's plenty of food and water, if there's good child care, if there's an acknowledgement for their service, if there's no pressure or responsibility, you know, to serve the church that they attend every week, or if no one hurts their feelings, or I don't, you know, say anything, you know, to ruffle their feathers from the pulpit, then they'll stand in a tacit approval. But if things get hard, if their feelings get hurt, if they are convicted by a pulpit message, if they feel like I'm aiming at them, if they're asked to serve in the church, if they're told no concerning some desire that they might have, then how quick they're picking up the rocks to stone me. And please, please, again, I'm not in any way schooling you guys. I mean, in my opinion, you're the best church around. I'm just stating, for our sake, for any of your brothers and sisters that don't attend this church and go to others, it should be a point of understanding, a point of prayer, a point of consideration. See, one of the things that I think every person should do, and now if you're a newbie here in this church, you should just wait and watch. Because we could be like just weirdos, and you just haven't figured it out yet, okay? So just kind of hang on, just watch, make sure there's no, you know, sacrificial chickens and, you know, no, you know, secret meetings with, you know, hooded, you know, nothing like that. But sometime or other, you're going to have to throw down. Sometime or other, you're going to have to go, you know what? It's my church. That's my pastor. Until I have a good reason to believe otherwise, I'm standing with this church and I'm standing with that man. And I'm not telling you that because I'm the one sitting here. Remember, I used to sit out there for a long time before I sat up here. Because if you don't make up that mind, sooner or later, when you're in it, that's not the place to decide. Because then it's emotional and all the rest. You need to decide. Do you trust your pastor? Then back him. And I love the fact I can give you this because there's nothing on the table. This isn't clandestine. There's no issues. Nothing. It's just I can actually put it out there with no agenda. Okay? Decide. If this isn't the church for you, find one. Find one where you can back the pastor. Because, you know, I don't want to see you spend 40 years in the wilderness and then die. I don't want you to spend 10 years in this church and go, I never did like that pastor. Well, dude, why'd you go to church here that long then? You know, go find a church where you like and you have a pastor that you like and you support. Serve the Lord, because as you guys know what I always say, when I'm dead and gone, you're going to remember. That pastor always kept telling us, we got one pass, one pass, one pass through this life. That's it. Don't throw 25 years away and divorce your spouse, or 10 years away and then go back to Egypt, or 10 years and then go to a different church and you hate the one you went to before. It's a waste. People would indeed have to deal with the Amalekites over the years that would follow here. Moses, now he would build a memorial, and the people would remember this battle and they would remember how they won. Maybe, just maybe, there might be a few people who would remember this the next time this same enemy came around. The next time, they wouldn't doubt Moses.
Oh, I remember. Hey, do you remember the last time the Amalekites came out? Oh, and then and Aaron held up his arms. And then Joshua, we whooped them. Okay, I remember. That's why the memorial. That's why we oftentimes look back. That's why we have the end of the year things. We look back over the year. Doesn't those things seem like, wow, that was this year? That seemed like 5 years ago. But those are to remind us. So when we go through the same battles, it's like, you know what? I have no reason to doubt the Lord. I have no reason to doubt my pastors. I have no reason to doubt my church. I'm standing. Because if not, then the Amalekites are just going to keep coming year after year after year. Now, the memorial or not, sadly, most of these people wouldn't remember this. One thing that is amazing, Joshua did. Now, why do you reckon that Joshua remembered? Maybe it's because Joshua wasn't sitting in the stands with pom-poms urging the army on, was he? Joshua was on the field. Joshua was there fighting. He was in the battle. He fought for Israel. He fought for God. He fought for Moses. And Moses was up there on the hill fighting for Joshua. You know what happens when you fight beside someone? It's hard to forget. You become very loyal when you're fighting on the same side, don't you? I think about those guys, and we probably will never know who they are, but I've imagined that crew who went after bin Laden. Can you imagine that? In them helicopters, the dark of night. You're not even supposed to be in that country, and you're scooping across low on the ground. Do you think those guys were tight? I bet they could anticipate every move each other made before they made it. And they completed their task and they got out of there. And forever, they'll get together at barbecues and say, wasn't that crazy, man? We took out bin Laden. Together, we took out bin Laden. That's what happens when you fight together. You're loyal. You don't forget. It's easy to turn on someone when you're warming a pew. That's just a fact, gang. One day, as God says, the Amalekites would be wiped from the earth. Anyone meet an Amalekite lately? Anyone goes, yes, I got a little Native American, I got a little Irish, and I'm half Amalekite. No, I mean, they're gone, aren't they? Just absolutely wiped out. So God is absolutely right. But until then, it's interesting that God was going to use these Amalekites to teach his people. To teach his people. And they would. Going on. We're going to do a little bit of this chapter, okay? Verse 1, and Jethro, the priest from Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, with her two sons, of whom the name of one was Gershom, and he said, I have been a stranger in the foreign land. And the name of the other was Eliezer, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. And now he said to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. Now, if I haven't already offended you tonight, just brace yourself, okay? A number of years ago, and maybe for you youngsters, you this could be just a vague recollection, but a number of years ago, the political religious right in this country became enamored with what we know of as the Family First movement. Everything for the longest time was Family First. And an incredible amount of Christian ease and, you know, in pseudo-family values just kind of just gushed forth out of this and kind of became this byline of the American Christian church on a wide scale. In those days, when someone was asked about their priorities, he or she would dutifully answer, why? Family first. And then out of the second position would prayed a plethora of minor priorities such as, well, service to God, et cetera, et cetera. Now, sometimes, especially in the latter years of this Family First thing, they would give this vague and ambiguous, well, Jesus is first, and then my family is second. But when they say Jesus is first, it would come with no elaboration, no practical application, no manifestation, just this nebulous idea. And then they would, you know, humbly put their family in the second place. And so you'd ask them, Jesus first, what does that mean exactly, Jesus first? That's like, Ford is the best, but I always drive Chevy. What does it mean? I mean, you know, Ford's the first. You'd have something would come out of that. You'd kind of drive some Fords once in a while, wouldn't you? So people say, oh, family first, whatever. But the only problem with this campaign is it's absolutely, positively not biblical. It just isn't. If you were part of that whole movement, has that ever crossed your mind? Did you ever think, let's look this up in the Bible? Because you're not going to find it. It's religious, and it's American, but it isn't the life that God called us to. Now, please don't rush for the door. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not in any way telling you this to diss the American family, to make light of the importance of the commitment you make to your family. Gentlemen, your feet will be held to the fire. If you can't do it, then don't get married. If you can't step up, then don't have a kid. Because you will be held accountable. So I'm not trying to make light of this issue or somehow to say this doesn't matter. Let's just look for just a second, and don't turn there because you don't have the time. What does the Bible say about family? Let's look here. If you want to take notes, you can look these up later. Matthew 12, 46 through 49, Jesus speaking. While he was still talking to the multitudes, behold, his mother and his brothers stood outside, seeking to speak with him. Then one said to him, hey, look, your mother and your... Hey, I put that in there. Look, your mother and your brothers are standing outside, seeking to speak with you. But he answered and said to one who told him, who's my mother and who are my brothers? And he stretched his hand toward the disciples and said, here is my mother and my brothers. Luke 14:26, Jesus says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and his mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he can't be my disciple. Oh, that's hardcore. Matthew 10:37, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Ouch. Philippians 3:8, here's Paul. Yes, everything else is worthless when compared with the priceless gain of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. I have discarded everything else, counting it all garbage, so that I can have Christ. Psalm 73:25, whom have I in heaven but you? I desire you more than anything on earth. That's just the tip of the iceberg, kids. Did you catch any family first in there? I didn't either. What am I trying to say here? Moses apparently left his family and went off to do the work of God. What in the world were you thinking, Moses? I mean, did you put God before your family? Yes, he did. So see, we need to stop playing political and religious games in this country. To be a Christian means he rules before anything. Paul the Apostle warns you single people. Hey man, you get married, makes things difficult. It's not going to be easier. Makes things more difficult because then you got to be worried about, you know, making your wife happy. And you do. And you do. Getting married is not just adding a little something to your life. It changes it dramatically. Some stuff is really cool. There are some aspects that are nice.
the reality is it changes your life. There's tough stuff there too. And then if you don't think that's tough enough, have a few kids. Because, you know, everyone knows that having a bunch of kids in your life, that makes life easy, doesn't it? You have more spending cash and, you know, a lot of more time, you know, for romance. No, I'm being facetious. It's tough, isn't it? Now, again, I'm sure it has its rewards. I never figured out what they were, but I'm sure they do. No, I'm only kidding you. Of course they have their rewards, but you have to decide this is a difficult thing. And I'm not trying to make a federal case out of this, but I think there might be some people that today would kind of get all up in Moses' face here for leaving his family and going off and doing what God had called him to do. Now, my vote is you go do what God's called you to do and take the family with you. That's my vote. The church here knows there won't be any overseas trips by myself. I a dozen more trips ago, I already made that clear. Not because I want her there, I do. I need her there. But, so I think you should do that. All this is being said, I'm not trying to pass judgment on anybody's family. I'm not trying to pass judgment on anyone's life here tonight. I want to state a clear biblical truth. And that is that family can never be a righteous excuse not to serve the Lord. You can try, but you're not fooling the Lord. Seek first the kingdom of God. First. And you know the cool thing about that? All these things will be added unto you. He'll deal with all of that first. So it's not family first. It's Jesus first. It always was. But, you know, politically, it sounded nice. So now Moses, father-in-law, comes to visit him. No doubt he had heard about the events that had transpired. Now, this was certainly pre-BBC and pre-CNN and pre-Internet, Yahoo, Google. But you know what? When God parts a sea and tens of thousands of people walk across on dry ground, and all the events of Egypt, the water turning to blood and the whole frogs and locusts and all that stuff. Listen, that kind of news spreads, doesn't it? As we go along here, you're going to see there's some armies that absolutely fear this group without ever even meeting them because they heard about their street cred. I mean, they had a rep going on. Especially those on the other side of the River Jordan, which they were afraid to go over there, and those guys were afraid that they'd come over there. So now Jethro, gotta love that name, he brings Moses' wife and kids to rejoin Moses now for the journey ahead. So he didn't just run off and leave his kids forever and ever. There was a time he needed to complete the task that God had called upon him, so that he would be the man that he was supposed to be and the leader that he was supposed to be. So it required this, because he was going to seek God first. I have no doubt he was a better man for it. That's a testing for all of us. Those of you that were at the retreat this weekend, kind of smacks of a little reminiscent of the weekend, huh? Okay, so what we have tonight, let's all stand.